And if I can introduce Annette Ollison, who's going to speak to us about the thorny issues of aggregations, correlations, diversification, and have a discussion about group risk issues.
Good afternoon. I've got, I think, increasingly short slot here before we're having coffee. So I think this is actually a super important topic, of course, in terms of aggregation, the impact of what assumptions is actually made here. So I think this is one of the key things that really impacts what the finalized DA number actually comes out to be. But it's also an area where I don't believe there's one golden method or the way to do it. I think there's very sophisticated approaches out there, and there's some people that are using things that are quite simple and sort of straightforward methodologies. But both of them will be, both end of the spectrum will be relying on substantial level of judgments. And how do we as actually try and defend that? And I guess the byline in terms of this part of the presentation is how do we position ourselves and document it in order to represent that in a good way, both to management, regulators, and who else we would need to do that for. This is quite hard to read this slide, but this is from the Chief Risk Officers Forum for Solvency II out, sort of lobbying to make sure that was sort of a recognition of the level of diversification will be recognized and looked at for Solvency II. So what we've got here is basically 13 large companies within Europe that have sat down and looked at what's the impact of diversification. And here's a reference from between level one and level four. So they are differentiating between the four levels they're quoting. Is the first level is within risk types, second one is between risk types, third one between both of those, but within different entities, but within the same geographical location. And then finally, level four is across, you know, as a group across all its operations across the world. And what they found was that between them, and here's just listed there, obviously, so we can't recognize, we don't know who the individual companies are, but we can see that it's between 30 and 60% diversification benefit that they reckon they get out of being part of a group. Of course, linking into this, if we're looking at these last levels, which is between entities and geographical locations, it becomes very important when we're defending and thinking about whether this is plausible. If we look at can capital actually move, because this would, this diversification between entities across jurisdictions would mean that capital can flow in certain ways. So that would be a part that FSA have been quite clear that they want us to be able to justify, and they're treating groups on a case-by-case basis. I think when we're looking at diversification, most of us would be looking at an ICA from a solo entity level, so we're probably only looking at level one and level two between lines of business and risk types when we're trying to capture diversification. But bigger groups will obviously be looking at getting sign-off to be able to operate across the level four and allow for that. So both of the discussion points I'm going to move into is trying to tackle both of those things. First slide is focusing on just the first levels within and single entities, and then at the second slide we'll be looking at the wider group issues. I personally think that part of this that's very important is to sort of get a process in place that allows us to look at year on year how we move assumption. If they're very judgmental based, how do we best do that? And I think I would be interested in what the views are around this room, and I think we as a panel would be, and I think we can maybe share some experience around that. So these are the questions I came up with, and I think I'm going to talk through some of them, and some of them I'll post back to you as an audience. The first part, which the paper's gone into a little bit, is about implicit versus explicit correlation. This is referring to what level do you actually model correlations at. So the paper would go into, you can do this by drivers such as inflation, catastrophes that hits across different lines of business, or the underwriting cycle, very importantly, that George had just talked about. But there's also different other links that need to be incorporated, which in dynamic modeling quite easily gets done in terms of you have the large claims, you have the reinsurance, and maybe credit risk that gets looked at as the scenarios happens. But over and above that, people might be looking at correlations between lines of business and tail correlations as well, and making decisions as to how to capture both correlation and dependency structures. What we believe is that it's really important to sort of keep in mind what is it we're trying to capture, because I think there's a lot of, before launching into sort of doing all the modeling, what is it actually we're trying to capture? And I think there's a lot of approaches out there. We were interested in, is there any sort of experience that you have in terms of how to make the decision of what levels of correlation, how do you build up and make a decision what to model? Is it a good question, or is it a anyone that has a view? I know most of us have models, like most have people have already models in place. Are you dealing with correlations?
Andreas Tanakas, Lloyds. The answer is a trivial one, but looking at the data is a good start.
Yeah.
Before starting the guesswork.
Absolutely. Yeah. So what's the experience? So around the data, obviously there's a very shortage of data. How to cope with that?
Well, I think one has to be pragmatic, but data can give you, even if they're not enough so that they give you accurate estimates mm-hmm. of correlations, at least they give you an indication of ranges.
Yeah.
So you have a prior expectation that there is a high correlation between this and this class, and a low or a zero between those other classes.
Yeah.
But if you start at least trying to quantify it, you might get an indication of what high means or what low means. Because at the moment, there isn't even a consensus of what the high correlation is. Mm. Is it 50% or is it 90% or is it 30%?
Absolutely.
At least by looking at data, we might start to get an idea of what high means, for example.
Mm. Because I think there's been sort of quite a use of both trying to do data and also consensus or sort of management sitting around and trying to sort of judgmentally say, is it high, medium, high, low, whatever. And I think that the ranges that people are, one is making that decision and one is what probability do I actually attach to that, which I think there's a huge diversity of views on that at the moment. Yeah. In terms of what levels of correlations to take into account, I suppose that depending on the granularity that this gets models, you would probably find the lower level you go to, the more diversification you might incorporate. And I think it's about understanding that and what's the driver of that. From many perspective, it's really about what does the model need to be used for, because it's not only a regulatory tool. So I mean, we could all model at a certain level where we'll have, you know, lots of diversification already incorporated indirectly by the choice of the level of granularity. But if it's going to be used to discuss a performance management or allocating down for pricing purposes, that would drive what level that model will be set at. Approach to aggregation. What have you seen as good approaches that works? Because I think that I see sort of two distinct ways that people are doing it, very much in a silo approach by line of like different risk types, or even by model and non-model risk and trying to bring that together. And some people who are trying to aggregate within the models themselves in a sophisticated modeling sense. Is there any experience that anyone would be willing to share around how you're finding bringing those aggregations together? Distinct quiet room. Is there anyone that has views on this? Yes,
Jim. Yeah, I've got some strong thoughts on actually how you go about aggregating and allowing for correlations. At the moment, as I see it anyway, is if you're taking a statistical approach, then a lot of it is very judgmental, as you mentioned before, and you might put a dependency structure around it or your distributions as well to come up with a calculation that produces a final number regarding the ICA, which has in it a lot of assumptions. I think what we need to start asking ourselves is, what are we trying to answer at the end of the day? At the end of the day, what we're trying to do is come up with a range of simulations, more or less around the 1 in 200, and trying to figure out exactly how these risks that we're trying to combine come together to produce the final ICA. And as I see it, one thing that the whole steer of this and one of the whole reasons for going down this approach is to incorporate this more into the risk management of the business, and therefore we should be trying to get more information from the business itself as far as what it thinks should be the 1 in 200 and how the key risks. Yes, we've got a silo approach as far as, yes, there may be a big catastrophe, there may be credit risk involved, there may be market risk involved, but the key question is how they all come together to come to that final number. And I think one approach is to go to the business and ask their views, get their views on that type of scenario and what their beliefs are, and try to incorporate that type of information in. Because at the moment, I think no one has the answer, and people are struggling to come to grips with, I think, coming up with some assumptions for a correlation matrix, putting it into a dependency structure, not really understanding how those all come together in the final answer as far as the ICA is concerned. And until I think we sort of get out of, yes, the model is good at actually doing this, but understanding is a whole different ballpark, I don't think we'll move on the debate any further.
So there was another comment, I think. Peter, do you have any?
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, clearly this is a huge area, and I don't quite know where to start, but given you asked for opinions, I thought I might as well give mine. I think there are places within ICA models where explicit correlations are appropriate. I don't think a silo approach is theoretically sound for capital modelling, and I'm glad that people are beginning to speak their mind on this point. I think I'd agree with the previous speaker that this is a complex area and people do need to begin to start thinking about it. But I would say the gold standard is to try and build some kind of causal structure, because at the end of the day, to set capital, you need three things. You need a risk profile, a risk measure, and a risk tolerance criterion. And you're building a complex system to try and get that risk profile, which may not, and it may not be possible to break it down into components that can be looked at on a standalone basis. Therefore, it may not be possible to measure diversification effects. So it's extremely difficult. So that's my opinion. Move away from a silo approach. Start thinking about it carefully. Don't try to do what's impossible.
Henry?
Henry Johnson again. Can I suggest, really directly in response to that, I was wondering whether to say this anyway, at the other end of the spectrum, let's not say suggest, just put forward the opposing view. I'm not saying that I necessarily hold it, or certainly that Lloyd's do. Quite a lot, I mean, insurance capital is very strange stuff indeed. It's not like the sort of capital you have when you grow pigs, where your pig pens wear out and it gets used up. Insurance capital either gets all used up or doesn't get used up at all, and it's completely unimpaired the following year. It's funny stuff, and all of these assessments of capital requirements are not about things that if we wait a bit longer we can know about. They are, in principle, unknowable things. There's nothing we can ever do or that can ever happen that will tell us what the correlation is between these events at 1 in 200. So it's not a lack of data, it's in principle not possible to know that. Therefore, perhaps what's right is what we agree as a community is right. When people buy insurance, they're buying insurance against some sort of standard of doing it right, amongst which is that they've got a fair chance that their insurance company will be there when they need it. Equally fair between the different insurance companies that are equally well respected or regulated. So if everybody does it right and honestly, there's an element of it doesn't matter too much how they do it, within reason. And therefore, if you pay some attention to the dynamics of the core business, the insurance, and do that in a proper sort of a way, taking account of the risks as well as you can, and then if it's convenient to do it in silos, and I think a lot of people do it in silos and then apply a correlation matrix, rather than arguing about what's theoretically right, do something which is practical, which everybody can do, where the regulator or the rating agencies or the investors can make some assessment of how well it's been done. It's not too complicated. Might achieve a better objective in the end than attempting to have something which it looks as though it's better when it's not possible to be any better because it's just unknowable.
Yes. Neil?
Neil Bruce, Cree Church. Just following on from Henry's suggestions, That generally implies that what we should be doing is using a market standard correlation matrix, which then, if we can't know it and nobody can know it, but what the regulators and everybody else want us to do is to come up with a number that's consistent across all the companies, then that stands to reason then you should be looking towards some kind of benchmarking exercise on correlations available to all the companies in the market. I mean, ICAs are basically a huge guess, and we're looking at such an extreme level of guess that it's small changes in assumptions, as we all know, will give large changes in results. And if we're after consistency, probably the only way we're going to get that is if we have some kind of market level information to assist us in coming up with our assumptions.
Take one more.
Tony just wants to come back to that, and then I know we have a speaker in the far corner there as well.
I don't know if this mic's on or if they do any good. I'll just try and project. From a personal perspective, I agree with everything you've just said. I can't speak for my employer, but it might be worth repeating something that I said in public, I think in November, when I didn't work for the FSA, which was almost verbatim what you've just said. There is a view within the FSA that that's possibly a sensible thing to do. But at the same time, one of the reasons we try and avoid doing that kind of thing is that there's a strong sentiment within the industry that the regulator shouldn't be there to dictate to the industry. The industry should be managing itself in a way that is appropriate. And it's the balance between those two conflicting requirements that we have to tread.
I suppose there will probably be a practical issue as well in terms of the mix of business being slightly different and the retention levels, and there's lots of, but I still think benchmarking could be, very interesting to see.
Can I just make one quick comment? So it's Justin Skinner from QBE, sorry, over here. APRA have actually gone down the benchmarking route. Cut off again. APRA has gone down the benchmarking route to a certain extent, and there was a study about 3 or 4 years ago where Tillinghast and Trowbridge published a correlation matrix between different lines of business, which the market was then compelled to use in order to generate their equivalent of the ECR. I've actually had a look at this matrix, and for me personally, I take issue with a number of things in there. One market level correlation matrix will never be suitable for everyone in the market. So going down a compulsory correlation route, it's just never going to work. Maybe as a benchmark it's useful, but in order to compel companies to use it, it's going to cripple the industry, to be honest.
They have the opposite point of view.
Martin Warren. A set of benchmark factors could be quite useful and could be quite comforting to everybody in the industry. My concern would be if there were too much comfort, eventually we should be careful that we should be looking at it critically and be prepared to move it.
Peter Smith, Canopius. Couple of points. First of all, on aggregation, then correlations, because they're connected. On what classes of business to aggregate together, I found that apart from wanting to do obvious logical groups, which are different, a major consideration was what reinsurance programs you've got, because as soon as you have a program straddling two different groups that you're modeling, or two programs in one group you're modeling, you have additional levels of complication. With me, it was very simple. It didn't create any conflict. But I'd honestly suggest that your reinsurance program may well automatically define some of your groupings. Second, on correlations, I confess that before now I hadn't thought of the idea of doing benchmarked correlations. My immediate reaction is I think it would be far too complicated to work, because we all have models tailored to our own business, so we have different things we're picking correlations between. Certainly, for instance, anything that correlates different classes of business in total result terms based on past history would be ignoring what I want to do, which is correlate the attritional claims, having modelled catastrophe and large claims separately. And indeed, on correlations for catastrophe claims, I do what's 100% correlation between different classes. So I model UK catastrophe and apply that to direct business and reinsurance separately. So a matrix of correlations, I think, would be beyond the achievable. On the other hand, we all know correlations are very difficult. It's exactly the area where you then say, well, do I start with 0, 25, 50, 75, or 100% correlation? What do I think is the most appropriate? How much does my answer change if I move it a lot? And if you get a very big sensitivity to it, then that is an issue for the board in describing your numbers, saying that our lack of understanding of how our business moves has a big effect on the capital.
I'm going to move on to sort of treatment of, I think, tail dependency we're sort of touched on in the sense that I think Henry talked about the 1 in 200. Like, do we work with different correlations just as we're doing the body of the capital modeling or when we're looking at the tails for what drives the capital? And that this can be dealt with in a number of ways in terms of copulas that might have more of the tail, or it could be using or stressing the correlation matrices for when it's in a tail and the extreme events that are happening. In terms of validation, I think it's a strong flavor is coming out that this is obviously very, very difficult and is quite judgmental, and I think that's coming through in a lot of the what discussion have been to now. What is the best way, what have people found as being the best way to actually sort of validate or get a sense of this? I mean, I think that there's a strong sense of using sort of other experts and get a sense in within the organization, does this look right? Even if it's copulas in terms of these are the types of profile it, that is creating, does that make sense? Is that what we're expecting? Other types of validation could be sort of stress and scenario testing in terms of ripple effects and does the sort of effect of the correlation on the overall capital, does that seem sensible? And I think another thing that's being increasingly useful to look at is sort of implied correlations between lines of business that's being captured by, and that's sort of looking at maybe the ultimate losses and looking at what does that imply between lines of business. These are sort of different ways of validating, and some of which we have touched on during the paper. But it's interesting, what have you found is in the, given this is so judgmental, is there a good way of validating it? Or does it come down to, yeah, we do think it's medium high correlation here and we're comfortable with it? Or low, medium, whatever it is.
Well, I think there's many ways to skin this particular cat. And a lot of it is about intuition. I think the danger of going down popular is that so you've got a button on a DFA model that says popular.
Yep.
There's like a button on the US immigration form that says, did you participate in Nazi war atrocities? You just learn not to hit that button because the event is so.
It's a big.
So dark. Well, I think that's unfortunate. But what I have seen is people illustrating their correlation by picking on. They can say, well, of all the events that caused me to fail, there's a distribution conditional on that. Mm-hmm. And there's a most likely direction in which I can fail. So I can think about the events as causing me to go bust, and maybe the most likely event there is a huge problem on my liability account, or my motor account, not going very bad at all. Mm-hmm. When I drill down, it's telling me something about the correlations I've assumed. But then looking at the events and saying, does that make sense? Is the way that you benchmark it. In the same way, if you're looking at the set of events that you would want to test at a 1 in 200 level, there's one of those that is worse for you. And to validate that, you just need to look through your historic experience and say, well, did I get worse than that 1 in 200 times? So you don't necessarily need to go and validate every single one of your correlation assumptions, which you know you're never going to be able to do anyway, it's never enough based on their own. Once you've sort of worked out reasonably where the answer is, you can do validation that involves testing experience in the region of that answer. And I think that, so I've seen several firms where that's really helped them to get their head around some of these dependency issues. Mm-hmm. Perhaps we've been spending a lot of effort in calibrating immensely complicated models, and many of those parameters are just affecting how solvent you are on the case where you're solvent, so not really that relevant for capital. And we're seeing a lot of people getting a bit more focused on the intersection of things that are likely and things that are painful. And that does enable you to make better use of the data and also to illustrate it better to people who don't understand copulas. Mm-hmm.
Anyone else want to add anything on this topic?
Also on the subject of copulas, there's a lot of theory on copulas, and they work quite well if you can understand what your tail correlation is. And as Henry was saying, the tail correlations can be a lot more severe and completely different than in normal circumstances. The only problem is that the copula theory in itself doesn't help you to parameterize, and you still have the problem of you can do the copula, but you can't get the parameters because you've never seen the event. So instead of going down that route, what I prefer is analyze different levels of correlations, including maximum dependence or maximum correlation. And if that's something you can live with within sort of the constraints of capital within your business, that's an easy assumption that everyone can understand.
Yeah. I think in some ways it's about also the ease of communication if you're not sort of going down the very scientific way, or can you communicate it in a way that people can challenge as well, which I think is important. ICA split by risk type is something that we're being asked to do, both by the regulator, both by the FSA, as well as Lloyds would like to see it as well. We've got to the ICA in some ways. We say that the sort of whole aggregation, diversification, correlation kind of issue is about, we're doing a lot of detailed modeling and we're trying to bring it to the ICA number, and it's some really key core assumptions that need to take place, and then we get that to our ICA number. And now we're going to allocate that down. Split by risk type is obviously going to be very driven by what kind of allocation methodology we might choose to use here, and whether we're looking at sort of marginal or sort of a proportional split of this ICA. Marginal can have its challenges, different ways of doing that, and won't go into it, but it's also around, do you switch things off, and is it, what does make sense? For example, if you're switching off insurance risk, what about the link to credit risk, and where does it make sense to sort of get to the marginal, the right way of getting to the marginal distributions? Some are doing it on value to risk and looking at 95 versus the mean. So saying I wouldn't want good to go into details, I think there's a couple of ways of doing it. It's very driven by the approach that's used for that allocation practice. What is there anything that I think actuaries, again, we're going to defend or present this? A lot of it is sort of, does it make sense? Is there some better way of doing that? Is there something we should share with each other in this area? Because it, like with the correlations, it's again quite a just mental decision that's lying with underlying it.
I'm just loving a question that's why it's even more difficult than it usually is. If you're trying to do, like you said, marginal, that's pretending to sophistication we have. Suppose you're trying to run your risk model with and without a certain risk.
That was what I meant by marginal,
before
thank
and after.
You.
Yeah. You've got to think about doing it both at the tail level and at the medium-term risk level.
Yep.
And you've got to look at both of those impacts before you take any business decisions. And that. So what I'm saying to you is it's even harder than you thought it is. So no easy solutions.
No, I don't think so. I think the other thing to bear in mind is that depending on how it's been allocated, it might be meant sense from a 99, if you're allocating a 99.5 versus when you're allocating for normal sort of business purposes, because I think depending on how what assumptions is underlying it, you might get different results, obviously. So that could be the same with diversification treatment, because the diversification effect won't necessarily work similar at different levels of confidence. There could be some decisions there.
Now, I wonder, Annette, if you mind, we'll
just move
into tea time.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll take this as the last question.
This is a fantastic conversation.
Yeah.
Perhaps if we can just have one more point.
Absolutely. Regulatory buy-in, I think, is one in terms of how do we actually document what we're doing. And year on year, if this is very judgmental, how do we monitor as actuaries that would we change our views on this? I think that's a key core question that we need to be better at. It is actually a wider question in terms of ICAs and understanding how they move on year on year. I think the last comment I would make is that in terms of DN12 that's coming in and getting more requirements for documentation, I think that's a question in what does that actually mean in terms of ICAs and what we need to document on some of the, I think correlation would sort of account for one of the core decision, the correlation and aggregation decisions would be one of the core assumptions and hence something that most likely would fall under these increased reporting requirements. So I guess we will need to think about how do we better document this area as a final observation. I think I'll stop here.
Well, that's a very interesting conversation. What strikes me is it goes to the heart of what insurance is about. We pool exposures on behalf of clients, and then we can charge them less than if they were standing on their own. So diversification is one of the core services we provide to our customers, and it shows what a tricky area it is, and we just have to work harder and harder at it all the time.
Thank you.
I'll now call a halt to that conversation, fascinating as it was. Could we express our appreciation to Annette for her